Well, good morning again. As usual, when I listen to one of Doug's sermons, something important pops out at me. And in order to make this lesson more meaningful, I had a kind of a revelation come to me this morning as Doug was reading the Ten Commandments. And we read them quite often in this church. But there was something about the way it was read this morning that really struck me. I'm probably more familiar with the Exodus version of the Ten Commandments than I am the Deuteronomy version. But I wanted to point out something that really struck me, and it's pertinent to what I'm going to say today. In Exodus, it starts out very simply. It says, "And God spoke all these words, saying," and then it goes right into the Ten Commandments. But in Deuteronomy, what does it say? It says, "And Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, 'Hear, O Israel, the statutes and rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. Not with our fathers did our Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain, out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go up into the mountain. He said, 'I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery.'" Now think about the difference between those two. In Exodus, God simply presented, the scripture simply presents the Ten Commandments. In Deuteronomy, it goes on to explain that before I gave you these commandments, you were in slavery. And that point in time was a long time from Adam to when God gave the Ten Commandments to his people. And what does it say about it? "I brought you out of the land of slavery. And I'm giving you this law now so that you will be my people." Okay? That's very, very important to us to understand that without the law, we're not yet complete in God. And that law is written in our hearts so that mankind has been governed somewhat by their conscience. But God is saying, "Now I want you to be my people, and I want you to follow my law." And if you think about the last several months when we were going through the book of Leviticus, the things that Leviticus revealed to us about the use of the law and the fact that God wants us to be holy, that separates God's people from everybody else, is that holiness. And the law is what that holiness is placed in our hearts so that we at least know that part of the law. Then I was thinking a little bit more, that as you're thinking about the Ten Commandments, and we remember that in Genesis it says that God created man in his own image. So we're created in the image of God. And that image is begun to be fleshed out a little bit in the Ten Commandments. And it says, I brought you out of slavery, and I'm going to give you the law. So I saw a link there between the law and our freedom. And it really became important to me as I'm as I'm presenting the way government has evolved from the beginning of mankind right up to and including now and in the future, that we're not free unless we have a law upon which those freedoms can be based. Now, the Ten Commandments give us our freedom spiritually, but you can parallel the fact that because we're created in God's image, there's also a law that we're to be governed by in our life on this earth. And we looked at the development of government last Sunday, and we started out talking about the fact that the very first forms of associations of mankind took place in the tribal setting, okay? And even in the tribal setting, there were heads of tribes. They were called chieftains. And those chieftains gave some guidance to the people, but not nearly to the extent that it enslaved them. Well, gradually it began to be that more tribes would gather together and they would form a village. And that village needed to have some structure to it. And so they would appoint one of the chieftains to be the chief of the chieftains. And so there began to be a little bit of structure to our governmental system. But in that process, we didn't really see a law being established. It was the whims of the chief of the chieftains that governed. And I can well imagine being part of that governmental system where if we had a really good moral kind of a chieftain, I could take comfort in it. But if we had a immoral chieftain, someone who wanted to take advantage of his position, I was defenseless because I had nothing upon which I could go to that chieftain and say, you're breaking the law. And so it was kind of a catch-as-catch-can sort of a thing where there was no structure, there was no ability for people to defend themselves. Only against outsiders of the village did they gather together for defense. And as they went about raising their crops, I saw a video this morning that just happened to come on my email, and it was pretty interesting because this guy talked about the fact that in the early days, a farmer, a person who grew crops, had to protect his crops from his neighbor because his neighbor figured out pretty early on that I can grow my own crops and really work very hard, or I can go over and get Chris's crops. Well, after a while, it grew to the point where Tim and I said, you know, if we went over to Chris and said, if you don't give us 10% of your crops, we're going to burn your crops down. So now we've got a crime syndicate beginning to develop over here. Well, there was no law. And so we did what we did because we had the might and the power to do it. I can't hear you, Eric.
That wouldn't work too well because Chris would probably be more of a cattleman. Just saying.
Well, as things grew, you remember in Greece where the hilly terrain kept them from a lot of invaders coming in, but down in the valleys, the villages would grow. And as they grew a little bit bigger, they developed a form of governance, and they called it city-states. And after the city-state grew, ultimately, they began to look outside their borders and decided that you know, these hills are getting awful hard to climb. I think we ought to go over here where there aren't as many hills and take that over. And so they began to maraud their neighbors. And in the meantime, there are people living up to the north of them that lived on the plains where they had crops growing of their own accord. They didn't have to plant the crops. And so they got antsy to have more wealth. And so they started coming down and attacking the Greek city-states. And so the Greek city-states then would find another city that they could sort of get together with for protection. And they got a little bit more structure there. Well, over time, we saw that the real start of formal government was when they discovered irrigation. And they needed a way to guarantee that Stas, who lives at the head of the river, doesn't take all the water because I need some and I'm clear down at the end of the thing. So that was the first formal government structure that came about. But that was really kind of a word of mouth sort of a structure. They didn't have a way to have everything written down because languages weren't very prevalent in those days in terms of written languages. And so that was an informal system of government. Well, then along came Rome. And Rome began to grow because people were attracted to it. They had good crops. They had all kinds of favorable things. And Rome really developed the first system of government. And Rome actually had a representative form of government. Unlike the very primitive systems before it, Rome had the Caesars, and below them they had the Senate. And the Senate was supposed to be the representatives. It was always selected from the royalty, but at least there was some measure of control over the Caesar. And Rome then remained in power for hundreds of years with that system. And they got very aggressive. And they took over all of the Mediterranean. And they went all the way up to England. And England was under Roman control until about the year 500. Well, when the church division started to take place, and there became an Eastern church and a Western church, the fighting between those two empires and all of the Vikings and everybody else that came down and tried to take them over, it basically bankrupted Rome. They couldn't tax the people enough. And in order to combat that, the Caesar named Caracalla extended citizenship to everybody in Rome. You remember in Jesus' time, Paul was a citizen of Rome, but not all of the apostles were citizens of Rome, even though they lived in the Roman Empire. Well, this Caracalla guy made everybody a citizen so he could tax them. Didn't work. And the empire only lasted about another 65 years. And the last Caesar fell, and Rome's empire was gone, and there was no formal government anywhere. And that was the beginning of the Middle Ages.
How did it fail?
What, Tim?
How did it fail?
Bankruptcy.
Bankruptcy.
They couldn't pay enough taxes to keep their armies going. And so they were taken over and sacked by the Visigoths. Came out of the north and they took them over.
So basically the failure was couldn't support the armies that needed to protect themselves?
Yeah. They're, all governments basically exist in order to get taxes. And most of them do it in order to fight wars. And that's something that's becoming very evident right now under Donald Trump. There have been wars throughout this entire history of our country of one nature or another. And most of them appear to have been instigated by the governments themselves because they could tax the people. And that's the way they disseminated wealth throughout the entire world. We would tax our people. We'd build up our military. Germany would do the same thing, and then we'd start bombing each other, or Japan, or wherever it was. And that made a lot of people very wealthy. And some of that wealth was spent over and over and over again, and so it dribbled down to the masses. And so it created a certain amount of wealth for everybody. But Donald Trump has recognized that those wars are evil. And just yesterday he announced that he's starting to pull our troops out of Iraq again. And he has withdrawn from every war that was going on when he came into office, except for a few troops still left in Afghanistan. Because Donald Trump, and I'm not trying to advocate on behalf of Donald Trump, I'm giving you some information that says he has recognized the evil of government that is based on war. Well, to move on from that now, I want to talk about what was going on in the Middle Ages a little bit. I talked some about this last week, and so this is a refresher course, but also want you to be thinking about, as we talk about these things, the spiritual ramifications of it. Because you remember the ultimate purpose of this class was to try and make some sense out of Romans 13. Where we're commanded to be under the authority of the powers that be. And I felt like we need to understand a little bit about how the powers that be came to be the powers that be. Doug had in his sermon the fact that God establishes the kings. That's something that we've all known, but I don't believe that that establishment is necessarily always a person, and we're going to come to that at the end of the class, I hope. But I want to talk right now about the degradation that took place after the Roman Empire, because Rome had some form of law. They had the councils. The emperor had to negotiate with the councils, and the result of that became the law of the land. When Rome deteriorated, there was no other government that was like that. And so we developed a period of about 600 years where there was no government on the earth that was formalized in to that extent. It went back to the fact that most of the wealth had to come from the land. And because there wasn't an orderly system of governance, there wasn't much trade going on in the world. And so Chris had to raise a crop for his family, and Tim had to raise one for his family. And so each of you would get control of some land, and you became the emperor of that land. But Tim didn't have to come to you because he had his own land. So it was only when greed began to develop And you decided, you know, I could feed my family a lot better if I also had Tim's land. And so now you begin to need to have an agreement between two different landowners in order to protect themselves from Chris.
Kind of reminds me of Abraham and Lot having to separate because the lands wouldn't feed them all.
Yeah, that was an earlier era, obviously, but it's the same idea. There was the intervening period where we had the city-states and the nation-states and all of that in the Roman Empire. But when that broke up, it reverted all the way back to what you're talking about. And so it was a pretty sorry situation. There was nothing that I, as a commoner, could do other than to obey whoever owned the land that I was working on. And there was no minimum wage prevailing because we didn't have certain aspects of our governmental system that thinks that you ought to be able to steal from an employer to pay an employee more than he's worth. So it was whatever you chose to give me that really set me up as whatever I was going to be. And so you could say at that point in time that a new form of slavery took place, didn't it? All of a sudden, I'm back in the situation I was in before the law. I wasn't free anymore. I was subject to the whims and the fancies of whoever owned the land that I was living upon and working at. And that took place for quite a long period of time. And so there were various efforts to say, look, when Rome went away, things turned really bad. So let's try and recreate Rome. And there were several efforts to restore the Roman Empire. Charlemagne tried it. The king of the Franks, the Pope tried it. Some Germans tried it, the Hohenstaufens and the Habsburgs. And then most notably, Napoleon tried to do it. None of them succeed because the impetus to build these large empires was kind of supplanted by the politics of the day, I guess. The landowners became the rulers, and there were lots and lots of landowners, and many of those got their land by creating war. Others got it by merging with somebody else who couldn't work the land properly. But still there was this element of slavery that took place because there was no law. And so as the world became somewhat more sophisticated, the first country to really begin to govern themselves as a nation state was Britain, when the Anglos and the Saxons decided to come together as a compact, if you will. They didn't become some form of a government until later on, but they had a compact that said the Anglos and the Saxons have their own land, but they're going to join together because these guys over in France keep coming over and trying to steal our land. And so they were the first ones to really consolidate power into a more formal kind of an arrangement. And that took place, along about starting in the 5th century. And as the Vikings began to invade and then the Arabs began to expand their empire down into Africa, and then they went over and took over Spain. And it became very important now for England to be able to protect themselves from that onslaught. And so once again, we have the specter of war driving the establishment of government. But once again, we didn't have a written law. What we had was the authority of whoever had the most power. And he was free to do whatever he chose to do. And that was either good, like under Richard the Lionheart, or it was bad under some of the other kings of England, for example. And so as these various things were happening around the world, there was one element of somewhat of stability, and that was the church. The church, of course, at that time was basically the Roman church, and the power was in the hands of the Pope, but they at least kept alive the fact that there needed to be some form of literacy. They had the scriptures, and that was in writing. It was the church that kind of held everything into some semblance of order. But it wasn't a formal government, and it was only through the persuasiveness of the Pope that there was any real structure to anything. Well, that began to crumble under King George the Eighth, or Henry the Eighth, I'm sorry. And Henry the Eighth, I don't know how many of you have ever watched movies about Henry the Eighth, but he had a kind of a wandering eye, and he felt like there was a young lady that was more beautiful than the one he had married, and he wanted to divorce the one he had married. And of course, the Catholic Church at that time wouldn't permit a divorce. And so Henry said, I think maybe I'll just establish my own church, and I'll make myself the head of that church, and I will consolidate my power by making myself the absolute monarch of the country. And so that was the real formalization, if you will, of a formal government, was when Henry the Eighth began to consolidate his power. And once again, there wasn't a form of law that enabled you and I to be able to say, you can't do that, because the king was the total ruler of everything. And I hope you'll excuse my voice, but all of this smoke has got me so boogered up that I can't talk, I can't breathe, and my nose runs all the time. So,
you have to wear a mask.
Huh? I couldn't hear you.
You'll have to wear a mask.
Well, let's talk about that. Annika, do you have your mask?
Yeah.
I will wear a mask like Annika's. Hold it up and show it to everybody. It's a large net. And that's the kind of a mask that I'll wear. Well, as this whole scenario is starting to unroll, it began to be important that there be some form of written law. And so at a point in time, the common folks decided to get together and rebel against the king. And along about 1215, the king finally succumbed to the pressure, and he entered into the first major written agreement between the monarchy and the people. And they signed a document that we all have heard of for all of our life, practically, the Magna Carta. I'd never read it because it's all written on one page and there's no paragraph breaks and it's not written in language that I can read. But that Magna Carta was the first time that the ruling authorities acknowledged that human beings have certain God-given rights, and he agreed to honor 63 different aspects of life in those days. That Magna Carta became the foundational document for a later developed constitution in England and the English Bill of Rights, and ultimately became the foundation document for our own Declaration of Independence and our own Constitution. And there are four of those Magna Carta paragraphs that still apply. And we're going to study the Magna Carta a little bit more later down the road, so I don't want to go into detail on what those are right now, because the others have been either swept into another document or just the need for them no longer exists. But it was a real turning point in the relationship between the common person and those that ruled over them. Remember now that the people that were in the ruling class got there by various different means. Okay? It wasn't because the commoner said, "I want you to rule over me." Sometimes it was by birthright. Okay, the oldest son inherits the land and becomes the new person that rules. Sometimes it was by the strength of force. Somebody comes in and murders the people that own the land and take it over or make them slaves. Sometimes it was by negotiated settlements. But never were the commoners involved in the process of establishing who was going to rule over them. But we saw this morning, when we looked at the differences between between Exodus and Deuteronomy, that law is the basis upon which freedom can exist. And so as we think about these things, we need to think about what was the situation with the law in these various governments. Well, in Rome, they had some formalized law, and there was some freedom. But when Rome went away, there was no longer any formalized law, and people became slaves to the landowners. And so that's kind of the situation that we find ourselves in as we begin to now focus more on Great Britain. Yes?
So, Pete, between the demise of Rome and the 11th, 12th century here, the rule of the jungle was ruled. The landowners who had weight and power behind them were the rule of the world.
That's correct.
And the only thing I can think of then ruling or even trying to talk to them was the law written in their heart.
Right.
That they knew there wouldn't have been any conflict if the law of God wasn't in the heart of the man.
Right.
I just think that's interesting to point out that God's Ten Commandments are in every heart, and they know it by even protesting landowners. Their unfairness. Okay.
That's basically.
I'll stay with you here. There was no written law like we're so used to law all over the place now. But, okay.
There was the written law of God because the church had it.
From the 4th to the 12th century?
Yeah, the scriptures existed.
I know that, but was it publicly known?
Well, to whatever extent the church at Rome was properly following the law,
okay. It
existed. Okay. And I'm not going to go deeper into how I feel about that situation.
Right.
Okay? You know, the beginnings of some form of a different way of having law during the feudal system, which is what I was talking about with the landowners, there needed to be a class of people that would provide the military support. And that's when the knights began to come about. And ultimately, the military power was in the knighthood, and the knights began to take over the control of the landowners. And so you had that whole period of time where the Knights of the Round Table were kind of the ruling group of people. It's a fascinating period of time because you can see all the aspects of human depravity.
Did King Arthur really pull the sword out of his thumb?
I can't hear you.
Yes, of course he did.
Did King Arthur really pull the sword out of his thumb?
Well, of course he did. I saw it in a movie. How could it not be true? Hollywood wouldn't deceive us. Well, it was these written agreements like the Magna Carta that took hundreds of years to become important enough that it began to govern whole nations. But it set the scene for developing a rule of law. Yes.
So the Roman Church had the law over the people from, say, the 4th to the 12th century.
Based on their ability to be persuasive.
That means they hid the teachings of Christ from the people that told them the law of love.
I'm shocked.
No.
I'm shocked.
No, we read the church. The churches that were established, even in Britain, the Catholic churches, they ruled the people.
Right?
Yes.
And then not nicely.
I'm reminded of the time that a question came up in the Vatican and they sent one of the young priests down to look at the scriptures because they kept them down in the basement. And he was down there for several days, and finally the bishop decided to go down and find out what's going on. And he went down there, and this priest was sitting there weeping.
Wow.
And the bishop said, "Why are you weeping?" He says, "The word was celebrate." Celibate? Celebrate. Never mind. But the Roman Church was not always very ethical in the way they handled things, and I'm not going to go beyond that. But Martin Luther will tell you about it. Okay. So the existing relationships between the feudal kings and the knights kind of kept the country from really becoming a country at that point, because they were all protecting their own little turf, and they had written agreements with the people that were under them. But I might have a different written agreement with my people than Brian would with his people, or Chris would with his people. But at least there was the beginnings of an understanding between the people and their rulers. And
you got that distinction. The people you're referring to were those of the ruling class.
That's correct.
He did not have any understanding of the serfs.
That's correct. They had...
They were basically slaves.
They had no authority. Okay? All of the governing systems at that point were based purely on territory. Okay? And so you had the kings in England and the kings in France and the kings in Holland and various other places. And gradually they began to take one another out. And so you began to see the nation state start to form. This is where we come to Henry VIII, who reigned from 1509 to 1547. And he was the one that declared himself to be the head of the nation. And at that point, then, he overruled the remaining kings and said, I'm the dude, and you're the duke. Okay? I'm the king, and you're not. But he also said to the Pope, I'm the head of the church, and you're not. And so that was the first real formal recognition of those who had been under the authority of the church that said we're not going to be under the authority of the Pope. Now, throughout history, there have been groups of people who did not fall under the authority of the Pope because they didn't want to be. And so those people continued to be outside of the authority of the Pope. So it wasn't like the whole empire was under the authority of the Pope. Once again, part of the problem that Henry VIII had was the fact that the invention of, or not the invention, but the ability to make gunpowder had begun to be very prevalent in society. And buying gunpowder was very expensive. But if you could afford the gunpowder, you could knock down the castles of the people that thought they were the rulers of their own territory. Well, poor old Henry, he just wasn't able to raise enough money. And so he needed to have some kind of a more formal way to coerce people into paying taxes. And he started out by trying to use chicanery to raise taxes. He would say to Rick, Rick, I'm going to give you a title. You're now going to be the Count of Dover. And Chris will be the Duke of Delaware or wherever. Okay? And so because I've given you a title, now you feel obligated to go to your people and raise money for me. So they did that. They also robbed the church. They robbed it blind. They stole money. For example, when Portugal expanded their empire, they started stealing money from the people in the countries that they went to, and they stole massive amounts of gold and silver from Mexico and Peru. So all of these people now are starting to get more and more greedy because at the same time this is going on, there'd be a kingdom over here that was growing bigger and bigger. And so now I got to grow bigger and bigger or else he's going to come and take me over. Because once again, it was power by force. Well, one development under Henry VIII was that they did begin to establish Parliament. Now, Parliament in England became the equivalent of the way the Romans did it. Okay, they had their own little group of people, the emperors on top or the kings on top, and then there's these guys down here that I have to negotiate with. And as was pointed out a minute ago, it was the royalty that made up that first parliament. And so once again, the little people had no say. They were supposedly represented in the parliament because that was, you know, Chris is my king or my duke. And so, Chris, I expect you to speak for my behalf. You may or may not feel an obligation to do that. So, we still had at that point then the ruling authorities with absolute power. Okay, the ruling authorities in the case of England being the king and parliament working together had absolute power. Well, what was the invention that turned all of this around? Surely you all had that element of history in school. What was invented that turned it all around?
The printing press.
Joyce and I went to the same school, and so we knew that it was the printing press. What did the printing press do? It what?
Printed the Bible.
I'm sorry, my hearing is really bad.
Printed the Bible.
Okay.
The Bible available to the people.
It printed all kinds of things, didn't it? It made the Bible available to the masses. But it also enabled laws to be written and widely disseminated. And so, as you begin to disseminate the laws, and it gets down to me, I'm on the bottom of the heap, and I look at what you've just handed me, and I say, that's not really fair, is it? And so I began to get a little bit more vociferous in my discussions with my duke. Chris, this isn't fair. You got to do something about it. And so the crowds began to be more vocal in their dealings with the people that were ruling over them. And we started to get a little bit more independent. I wore this tie this morning for a purpose. This is the Do Not Tread on Me tie. Well, I'm one of the people. And I just said to Chris, stop treading on me. Okay? Well, that's kind of the middle attitude that was beginning to develop from the time that the printing press was invented in roughly 1450. Now, I went back and I studied some about the printing press. It's really interesting. People were using mechanical means to reproduce documents as early as the 600s. But what they had to do was they had to carve out the document manually on a piece of wood. And then if they were able to carve it sharp enough, they could press a piece of parchment down on top of it and it would print on it. But that was very laborious. So it was when Gutenberg invented the printing press that they could suddenly now turn out thousands of copies of a given document. And it revolutionized the world, probably more than any invention had ever done up to that point, maybe even forever. Well, what do you think the monarchs did when I started complaining vociferously? They said, that blankety-blank press, they're waking Pete up. We got to shut them down. And so even in the early days, they began to try to control the press and censor the press and say, you can only say what I can tell you, what I tell you to say. But there were enough good people down there running printing presses at that time that they were mass producing things that the government didn't necessarily want to have produced. The period of time during the early days of the printing press was called the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was really the rebirth of literature and art in the world, okay? Because now we've got the ability to distribute these things to the people. There was another great event that took place partly or mainly as a result of the printing press. Now, what do we celebrate in our church? Called the Reformation. Okay? People were beginning to read the scriptures and beginning to see that the way the Roman church had interpreted the scriptures was not faithful to the scriptures. And without anybody being able to call the Roman church out, because they didn't know, the Roman church was free to get as corrupt as they wanted to get. And I don't know if you've ever gotten out your Haley's Bible handbook or not, but there's a section in the middle of that that describes each and every one of the popes during a certain period of time. And if you want to read a disgusting revelation, read that. I haven't read it for many years, but there were some very, very evil popes. And I think that's probably why the 1689 confession that we subscribe to calls the Pope the Antichrist, because those particular popes were extremely evil.
Well, that crew they got in there right now makes them look like choir.
You think?
I know.
We're going to get into that a little bit later in the class in some detail. The Reformation really began to transform all of society, didn't it? Because suddenly the truth was being proclaimed all across Europe. And yet, just as there are now, there are people who do not want us speaking out the truth. Look at John MacArthur's church, for example. Four times they have been sued or shut down by a vile, wicked governor who does not want us preaching the gospel. Our own state, they shut down the church. And I'm convinced that if you read the Ten Commandments from their point of view, they'll say, this is really bad stuff because I can't do what I want to do. And so that really is the birthplace of the conflict that starts to come out in the open and has taken thousands of years to really get open. But the Reformation was really reforming some of the governments as well as the church. The Church of England ultimately became the Anglican Church, and you know, for whatever you want to say about it, at least they began to preach some of the scriptures right. And there were pulpits all over Europe that began to preach, and you had the great reformers come out of this period, starting 100 years before the Reformation. But particularly during the Reformation. And as these guys started preaching, it became obvious that God's word is a rock upon which God intended us to be either free or not free, depending upon our spiritual condition. But since we're a mirror image of God and we're living in this kingdom and that kingdom, we kind of have to begin to bring some of that kingdom down to this kingdom, don't we? So we have to begin to establish some laws to govern our earthly life as Christians. And there were people, again, who resisted that. When you go back and you begin to study the people that came over on the Mayflower, for example, They had left England 12 years before and went up to live among the Dutch. But even the Dutch were not giving them the kind of religious freedom that they yearned for. And so they left and came over to our country. And here we come to the second document that we're going to spend a little time studying. It's called the Mayflower Compact. And the Mayflower Compact was really a negotiation among the people that were on that ship. There were only about 45 believers on the ship. The others were just people that bought passage to come over. And yet, they were all going to be part of the same village. And William Brewster particularly was persuasive enough that he said, we have to recognize that there is a need for law among us. And that law has to come from the consent of the people. And we need each one of us on this ship to consent to a form of government. And then they went on to describe the principles upon which that form of government would be laid. And we're going to leave it at that point today and come back next Sunday and we'll go a little bit deeper into that. But I think you can begin to see that there are some themes that have recurred throughout history. There has been wars throughout history. There have been the need for government of some sort throughout most of history, but there was no basis upon which those governments could be for the benefit of the people. There were forms of government that relied on war for their very existence. That's a horrible basis upon which to form a government, isn't it? To take some of your people and kill them off to kill some of your people. That's a horrible way to have a government. But that's what existed throughout all of history. And then there was taxation. And that taxation became the source of many of the wars. It was also the solution to many of the wars. If I could raise more taxes than you could, I could stop the war by beating you up. So those are the things we're going to consider now going into our next set of discussions. Any comments or questions?